1943. Chapter 10. The Prominente Club. War stories are usually about what happened. The story of Colditz, by contrast, is largely a tale of inactivity, a long procession of duplicate days when little of note occurred, punctuated by moments of intense excitement. The ennui was not confined to the prisoners. "It's boring in the camp," Schädlich wrote in his diary. "The French have caught a mouse and are letting it drift down on a parachute from the fourth floor." The prisoners' existence followed a set pattern. Morning roll call, breakfast in their quarters, dishwashing and tidying, then study for some. Neutral language teaching continued to thrive. The midday meal when the cookhouse bell rang and the orderlies collected the rations from the German kitchen. Then, lying in bed, reading or playing cards until the afternoon roll call, a game of stool ball or another sport, more cards, escape plotting or kit making for some, tea at 4 o'clock, then trudging around and around the courtyard in the eternal circle. The hours between meals and roll calls were worn away in a cycle of smoking, sleeping, and self-abuse. Colditz was a highly literate place, with regular literary discussions, lectures, and a wide variety of books available, including numerous works in German, ranging from Nietzsche's philosophy to translations of Hitler's speeches. Reading matter was supplied via the Red Cross, and Penguin Books set up a system whereby, in return for an annual subscription of 3 guineas, individual prisoners received a monthly parcel containing a selection of 10 books. These books had to pass censors in Britain to ensure no vital information was transmitted to the enemy, and German ones in case the pages contained secret intelligence to aid escapes. A handful undertook correspondence courses to obtain qualifications that might be useful when and if they returned home. Eggers proudly opened a prisoner's library. Padre Platt was the librarian and moral arbiter of the prisoner's reading habits. "A minority read good literature," he decided, "but far too large a section of the camp reads nothing but fiction." Some passed the hours inventing ever more ingenious forms of goon baiting. When a large wasp's nest was discovered in an ivy-covered wall, the British came up with a new way to irritate their captors. Individual wasps were trapped, and then a cigarette paper bearing the words "Deutschland kaputt" was carefully attached to one leg by a thread, before the insect was released in the hope that the angry wasp would sting a German citizen and pass on the message. At one roll call, in a unique act of entomological propaganda, dozens of message-bearing wasps were released simultaneously. It was like a reversed snowstorm, with the wasps flying upwards in furious mood, recalled an eyewitness. Such diversions were short-lived. There was seldom anything new to talk about, and so the prisoners tended to say the same things to the same people, again and again. Even the most interesting individuals become crashing bores in prison. Lights out at 9:30 p.m. came as a blessed relief, for it meant the end of another wasted and useless day. It was an existence that many of the inmates had been prepared for by the harsher side of public school life, wrote one prisoner, the worst privations being the lack of exercise and sex. No Colditz prisoner ever had intercourse with a woman, with one possible exception. The Czech fighter pilot, Čenek Chalupka, inevitably nicknamed Čeko by the British, was a debonair figure with a plausible manner and a rakish moustache. Flight Lieutenant Chalupka had flown in the Czechoslovakian Air Force and then for the French after the German invasion of his homeland, before coming to Britain and joining the RAF. He liked to number his medals from 3 different air forces as if they had been awarded for amorous conquests. "This is for loving a blonde, this is for loving a brunette, this is for loving a redhead." Assigned to 615 Squadron, he was shot down in his Hawker Hurricane fighter off the Belgian coast on the 6th of October 1941, and he was captured. Puckish, dynamic, uproarious and explosive, Kalupka was a most unruly prisoner, and in January 1943 he was dispatched to Colditz. On the train to Oflag 4C, Kalupka and his guards found themselves sharing a compartment with an extremely attractive young woman. Irmgard Wernicke was 19 years old, 4 years younger than the Czech airman. Czecho spoke fluent German. "It was quite a long trip," Kalupka later recalled, "and we had time to get to know each other." Irma explained that she worked as assistant to the Colditz town dentist, Dr. Ernst Michael. Her father, Dr. Richard Karl Wernicke, was headmaster of the nearby agricultural school and a senior figure in the local Nazi party, whose home backed onto the castle grounds. Czecho, in turn, described his flight from Czechoslovakia, his adventures as a pilot, and his capture. Like Czecho, Irma was a romantic and a rebel. By the time the train pulled into Colditz, she was smitten. As they alighted, Irma whispered that Czecho should feign a dental emergency so they could meet again. A few weeks later, Kalupka deliberately chipped a tooth. The resulting dentist appointment turned out to be more thrilling than most. He left his muffler behind. Irma ran up the hill to return it to him. They kissed on the road to Colditz, with the amused German guard looking on. The unlikely start to a passionate love affair between an imprisoned Czech fighter pilot and a German dental assistant. In the early days of Colditz, Dr. Mikhail and his pretty assistant had visited the castle once a week to attend to the prisoner's teeth. But this arrangement came to an end early in 1942 when the dentist's winter coat was stolen from a locked cupboard, along with his scalpels, drills, and even his surgical gown. After that, he insisted that prisoners needing treatment must be brought to his surgery in the middle of the town. According to a fellow prisoner, Czecho managed to get to the dentist 5 times by smashing a few teeth so badly on rocks that they needed a series of treatments. Word swiftly went round that the Czech was now the only inmate of the castle ever to have kissed a girl. Kalupka hinted he had done a lot more than kiss Irma on these occasions. If they did have sex, this can only have been done with the connivance of Dr. Mikhail, and may well have been achieved by bribery, Czecho's other principal talent. Within weeks of his arrival, Kalupka had emerged as the chief coordinator and controller of the camp's illegal barter system. Using cigarettes as enticements, he established friendly terms with several of the guards. Through these so-called soft goons, Czecho seemed to be able to obtain almost anything. Railway timetables, eggs, tools, fresh onions and information. From there, it was a short step to blackmail. Threatening to shop a guard who had taken a bribe was a most effective way to force the man to accept another. Czecho was a master dealmaker. If the price of enjoying sexual relations with Irma was a few damaged teeth and a lot of cigarettes for the town dentist, then that, in Checo's view, was a bargain. A man of considerable charm and presence, possessed of an irresistible exuberance, Czecho was also a fantastic show-off, who revelled in his reputation as a black market fixer and Lothario. Kalupka later described his typical day. He liked to rise late, enjoy a leisurely breakfast cooked by his personal chef, wander up to the second floor of the East Wing to observe, through a lecherscope, his favourite Popsy in her panties as she was dressing, then a light lunch, some profitable trading with the guards, a game of cards, back upstairs to watch Irmgard disrobing in her bedroom, and excellent supper, a conversation about the progress of the war, and so to bed. How much of it was actually true may never be known. But this was exactly the kind of account to excite the envy and admiration of Cecco's sex-starved fellow inmates. Opportunists like Kalupka thrive on upheaval, and his arrival coincided with another regime change in the camp. In February, the commandant was sent to take over the administration of camps in Ukraine. Glacier never got to grips with the combative culture of Kolditz, and in recent months he had seldom emerged from his private quarters. His replacement, Oberstleutnant, or Lieutenant Colonel Gerhard Prawit, the third and last commandant of Kolditz, was a typical Prussian martinet, redeployed from the Eastern Front. At 44, he was younger and more active than most of the men under his command. One of his first acts was to dismiss the easygoing alcoholic Hauptmann Prim, who took early retirement and soon after drank himself to death. New machine gun posts were erected, and fresh fields of barbed wire rolled out around the castle's slopes. To instill greater discipline, the number of roll calls increased to 4 a day. The prisoners now had to form up for counting at 7 a.m., 11 a.m., 4 p.m. and 10 p.m. "If this doesn't work, 6 to 8 roll calls a day," Prawit warned the senior officers. From the start, he refused to tolerate the sort of rebelliousness that had taken root under Glacier. "If a POW does not obey orders," he told the guards, "repeat the order and push your rifle into his back. If he continues disobeying, shoot him on the spot." Eggers favoured a more subtle approach and confided to his diary, "Prawit is the most ignorant commandant I have ever had." He was about to face a challenge to his authority from a most unlikely quarter. Birendranath Mazumdar still wrestled, in secret, with the most difficult decision of his life. A discreet word with Eggers would see him back in the first-class compartment on the train to Berlin. Soon after that, he might be the senior medical officer of an army fighting for Indian freedom under the leadership of the great Subhas Chandra Bose. It was a painfully tempting vision. But to take that step would be to exchange integrity for freedom, and that Mazumdar could not do. "Honour and fidelity are not double-edged," he reflected. "One can be honourable when times are not hard, but when honourable intentions are changed in a crisis, such as captivity, then that person can no longer be called honourable." The same is equally true of fidelity. To honour one's own promise is the bounden duty of every individual who so pledges, come what may. Anyone who diverts from that sacred path, no matter for what reason, is despised and looked down upon. An honourless person is not a human being. He ought to be classified with the quadrupeds. The Indian doctor nursed his principles in solitude. When a second doctor, an Irishman named Ian Ferguson, arrived in late 1942, Mazumdar greeted him gloomily. "You'll rue the day you came to this madhouse. Most of us are cracked here, and it won't be long before you're the same as the rest." Life in Kolditz had become unbearable, Mazumdar reflected. He had to get out. I was fed up. I had to prove that I could escape. In accordance with the Nazi insistence on racial stratification, the Germans had set up a handful of camps in Germany and occupied France, containing only Indian prisoners, mostly soldiers of the British Indian Army captured in North Africa. The security at such places was well below Kolditz standards. If Mazumdar could get himself transferred to an all-Indian camp, he calculated, there might be a better chance of escaping. If not, he would at least get away from the rumours of disloyalty that dogged him in Kolditz, find someone to talk to in Bengali, and resume his medical work. He asked the new commandant for a transfer, insisting he had a right to be imprisoned with his compatriots. He pretended to be vegetarian, claiming that the camp food was a violation of his religion. Whenever the Swiss, as the protecting power, came to inspect, he lobbied them to ask the prison authorities to move him. Nothing worked. "I keep trying to force the Germans to let me return to work in a stalag," he told Dr. Ferguson, but they take no notice of me. The Germans pointed out that Mazumdar was officially Deutschfeindlich, and therefore in exactly the right place. One February morning, in conversation with the Irish doctor, Mazumdar announced, "You know, Ferguson, I have decided not to stay here any longer. There's no good an Indian trying to escape through Germany, so I shall just have to arrange to go out through the main gate. I'm prepared to bet you that I shall not be here in a fortnight." Ferguson was astonished. "You think I am joking, don't you, Fergie? Well, I will show you that you are wrong." The Indian doctor had decided to deploy what he called the sole weapon open to me. He would go on hunger strike. During the 1930s, Mahatma Gandhi, Mazumdar's political idol, had staged a series of highly publicised hunger strikes to demand an end to British rule in India. On the 10th of February 1943, detained without charges by the British, Gandhi began his 15th such protest, insisting he would eat nothing until he was released. 2 days later, Mazumdar launched his own hunger strike. He told Ferguson, "The Jerrys will not find it very good propaganda in the Far East if the news gets around they have allowed an Indian to starve to death." He then took to his bed, declaring he would consume nothing but water and a little salt until the commandant relented and moved him to another camp. Food was the second most widely discussed topic in Colditz after escaping. The idea that a prisoner might voluntarily forego nourishment struck the others as bizarre. The British officers mocked him. "Jumbo is doing a Gandhi." But the doctor just smiled and said, "I know what I'm doing. We shall see what we shall see." The Germans were initially surprised by Mazumdar's one-man protest, then mildly amused, and finally deeply alarmed. After a week of starvation, Mazumdar had lost half a stone. Ferguson urged him to call it off. He politely refused. The German doctor examined him and reported back to Commandant Pravit that Mazumdar was sinking fast. He could not keep the anxiety out of his voice. Eggers was becoming seriously concerned. The senior British officer appealed to the new commandant to rescue the Indian doctor from his self-imposed fate. Messages flew between Colditz and Berlin. By the end of the second week, Mazumdar was too frail to leave his bed, but he remained resolute. "I have never seen a man more determined about anything," wrote Dr. Ferguson, who issued bulletins on Mazumdar's health every 4 hours. Unteroffizier Schädlich noted in his diary, "The English Indian doctor has not eaten for 14 days. He only drinks tea and smokes. His eyesight was starting to fail, and his heart rate was dropping. Yet he continued to smile and reiterated, 'We shall see what we shall see.'" Delirious from hunger, Mazumdar tried to focus on the Hindu fasting ritual of Upanayana he had undergone as a boy, the sacred thread ceremony, and willed his body to fight on. "I was getting weaker and weaker," he recalled. His father's words kept coming back to him. "Never forget what you are, how you were brought up, what good luck you had." On day 16, the German army blinked. A message arrived from army headquarters in Berlin. Dr. Mazumdar should cease forthwith his hunger strike and prepare to leave the camp as soon as he has regained his strength. Mazumdar's hunger strike had borne fruit. Gandhi's protest didn't. The British ignored it, and he resumed eating after 21 days. The other inmates instantly forgot how poorly they had treated Mazumdar in the past. The Indian doctor was the hero of the hour. The suspicion and prejudice that had always clung to him evaporated overnight, and as he emerged into the courtyard, weak and gaunt, but grinning broadly, he was greeted with loud cheers. People who had shunned him now declared they had always liked him. "We were all sorry to lose such a determined personality from our midst." They plied him with food to build up his strength. the British officers fed me up sumptuously. Harry Elliott, the officer who had accused him of spying and ended up being pummeled on the washroom floor, now apologised. "I'm very sorry," he said. "I am extending an invitation to stay with me and my family after the war." Mazumdar had been barred from escaping on account of his skin colour. But now, as he prepared to leave, the escape committee presented him with a brand new arse creeper filled with German banknotes. A gesture of racial solidarity that was heartfelt, if somewhat unusual. On the 28th of February 1943, just as he had predicted, Mazumdar walked out of the front gates of Colditz. After a week in a fetid Indian camp on a former polo field at Bayonne in southwest France, he was loaded onto another train with a group of prisoners heading north. "You're mad," a fellow Indian officer told him, when Mazumdar confided that he intended to jump off the train. Near Angoulême, with the help of two Indian sappers, he levered out the carriage window and jumped through it. The train was still moving pretty fast. With a broken finger, he set off south on foot, hoping to cross the Pyrenees into neutral Spain. French peasants provided food, clothing, and directions, but in a small village near Toulouse, his luck ran out. "I foolishly inquired from an old Frenchman the whereabouts of a bridge. The man led him to a building, which turned out to be the police station." Mazumdar was arrested and handed over to the Germans. "My first contact with the Gestapo was anything but pleasant," he recalled, with ringing understatement. "I had a rough time with them." He was interrogated and badly beaten up, first in the cells at Agen, then in Gestapo headquarters at Toulouse. After one particularly savage thrashing, his nose bled for an hour. But he adamantly refused to admit the names of the French civilians who had helped him. The Gestapo seemed to know all about his meeting with Subhas Chandra Bose. "We'll give you one more chance to join us," they said. "I'm not doing anything of the sort," he replied. So they beat him up again. Mazumdar assumed the Gestapo would eventually run out of patience and kill him. At best, they might send him back to Colditz. Instead, on the 17th of April, he was taken to Frontstalag 153 at Chartres in central France, a camp for colonial prisoners, where 500 captive Indians were guarded by a garrison of French Algerian troops under German command. As the only officer with a British commission, Mazumdar was the most senior soldier in the place. "I had joined my compatriots," he wrote. "I had reason to be pleased." He began planning his next escape attempt. "I was determined to get away, come what may." At the same moment, back in Colditz, another solitary prisoner also found companionship. Giles Romilly, Churchill's nephew, spent his nights alone in his cell and his days under constant surveillance. But in February, he was joined by a second VIP prisoner, a captured commando who had avoided execution through a heroic feat of bogus name-dropping. The Germans believed him to be the nephew of General Sir Harold Alexander, the British commander of Allied forces in the Middle East, which he was not. Lieutenant Michael Alexander was a 22-year-old officer in the Special Boat Section, the marine equivalent of the Special Air Service, or SAS, founded by David Stirling in 1941. Where the fledgling SAS had pioneered a new form of warfare in North Africa by crossing the Libyan desert to attack Axis airfields along the coast, the SBS performed a similarly destructive and secretive role, but by sea. Alexander had been playing tennis in Alexandria in the summer of 1942 when he received a message summoning him on a mission to sabotage a munitions dump behind enemy lines. He had no time to change into uniform. The team of 20 SBS commandos travelled 40 miles up the coast by high-speed torpedo boat, and then, in darkness, paddled ashore in rubber boats, only to find they had landed in the wrong place. A tented encampment of the German 90th Light Infantry Division, a crack unit of the Afrika Korps. The mission was aborted, but while the others returned to Alexandria, Alexander and one other man, Corporal Peter Gurney, insisted on continuing alone. This proved to be an error. The two men walked through the German camp in the dark, attaching time bombs to two tank transporters, an armoured car, and an ammunition depot, before setting off on foot for the British lines, some 25 miles to the east. By daybreak, they were hungry and thirsty, and in the middle of another encampment. They entered a tent, captured six German soldiers at gunpoint, tied them up, stole their Luger pistols, and then ate their breakfast of spaghetti bolognese and coffee. They were both captured soon after. Alexander was not dressed for his role as a commando. He was still wearing his gabardine trousers and silk shirt from the tennis court, now supplemented by a stolen Afrika Korps cap. A young German officer, who spoke perfect English and said that he had been up at Oxford in 1938, politely informed them that they would now be killed. They had murdered two Germans asleep in the tank transporter and were dressed, at least partially, in German uniform and thus suspected of espionage. Under Hitler's commando order, they were liable to summary execution. Alexander had a timely brainwave. Intending to play on the caste snobbism that was part of German military tradition, he encouraged Gurney to mention that he was not just a vulgar saboteur, but a nephew of General Alexander, already a figure of repute among the Germans. The new commander of Allied forces in Cairo was, in fact, his second cousin once removed, but Alexander reckoned he knew just enough about the family to bluff his way through an interrogation on the subject. Rommel himself ordered a stay of execution. When an aide pointed out that Hitler had ordered the killing of all captured commandos, the field marshal replied, "What? Shoot General Alexander's nephew? You damned fool." The other British captive could claim no illustrious relatives. Corporal Gurney was taken off in another direction, wrote Alexander, who spent the rest of his life wondering what terrible fate had befallen his companion. Gurney was never seen again. Alexander was moved from one prison to another until, in February 1943, he was taken to Colditz, marched across the courtyard and ushered into a small room. By a barred window was a short, square figure wearing an old brown dressing gown and trying to swat a fly. "Herr Romilly," said the guard, "we have company for you." These two men would form the nucleus of the Prominente, the group of important prisoners held under rather special supervision, as Alexander put it. The two men had much in common, including uncles they barely knew, whose fame had brought them to Colditz. In time, these two would be joined by additional elite prisoners, selected from POW camps around the country, the sons of British aristocrats, politicians, senior military figures, and members of the royal family. The Germans followed eclectic criteria for who was and who was not sufficiently elevated to be admitted to this small group. Colditz inmate John Arundel, the 16th Baron Arundel of Wardour, was a bona fide blue-blooded aristocrat, but lacked the political or royal clout to be deemed truly prominent. Max de Hamel, a tank commander who became the seventh member of the Prominente group late in 1944, had no idea why he was accorded this dubious privilege until he remembered a recent letter from his grandmother, which contained the line, "Met some of Mr. Churchill's grandchildren, who are cousins of yours." This was news to de Hamel, and of considerable interest to the German letter censors, who alerted the authorities. De Hamel reckoned he was probably the Prime Minister's third cousin. Every individual has an average of around 850 third cousins. But this slender blood tie to Britain's Prime Minister was enough for the amateur genealogists of the Third Reich. Max de Hamel was shipped off to Colditz on the basis of a snippet of homely gossip in a letter from his family. To twist Groucho Marx's dictum, the Prominente formed a club which his members had never wanted to join. Yet membership brought certain privileges. Greater privacy, more space, a gramophone, and better food. Since the VIPs were not permitted to exercise in the park, the commandant agreed that they could take parole walks, like Douglas Bader, accompanied by four guards armed with machine pistols. "It is beautiful country," said Eggers, "rather like your Cotswolds." As they wandered the lanes around Colditz, Michael Alexander would pick thyme from the hedgerows and later traded it with the French for bully beef. The Prominente did not exactly look down on the other prisoners, but as in civilian life, these men enjoyed a different status. One of the group described prison life in Colditz as the country gentleman set-up, and was surprised to find so many people who came from my own walk of life. The exception was Max de Hamel, who was not quite of the same class. "He had the air of a chamberlain looking for an emperor," Michael Alexander observed snootily. Giles Romilly was a communist, but crucially a socially connected upper-class one. The lowest and uppermost classes of Colditz were both more securely incarcerated than the middle-class prisoners. The orderlies were not expected to escape, and the aristocracy of Colditz society was kept under such close surveillance that getting out was impossible. When Romilly attempted to do so, disguised as a rubbish collector, he was intercepted and sent back to his cell with the mocking admonition that Mr. Churchill's nephew should not be getting his hands dirty in this way. But while they enjoyed a peculiar form of privilege, the Prominente knew that their exceptional treatment in Colditz was not a measure of deference, but a cynical calculation. They were bargaining chips, to be cashed in when Hitler felt the need. Clubs were, and remain, a bizarre British preoccupation. Whenever three or more Englishmen are gathered together, a minimum of two will attempt to form a club from which the others are excluded. Allegiance to a particular tribe, whether a football team or a gentleman's club in Pall Mall, runs through British male culture like veins through marble. Often absurd in ritual, rigidly hierarchical and rigorously exclusive, these defining grouplets can be hugely significant to their members and no one else. A certain sort of clubbable Englishman is happiest when admitting a like-minded person into his club or blackballing someone who isn't. In Colditz, the distinct messes evolved into small clubs. The House of Lords, the Kindergarten, a poker school of White's Club types. The old-school tie mentality not only persisted, but was exacerbated under captivity, as the inmates sought to build a replica of the lives they had known before the war. The old Etonians, Platt noted, tended to be particularly clannish, to the point of coordinating their bodily functions. They ate together, paced the exercise ground in twos, threes or fours, attended the same lectures, and went to the abort, or lavatory, together. Colditz even had its own Bullingdon Club. Modelled on the all-male Oxford University private dining club that has since become a byword for elitist philistinism. In the 21st century alone, Bullingdon alumni have included two Tory prime ministers and a Chancellor of the Exchequer. The Colditz Bullingdon was mostly old Etonians with the necessary old school and horsey characteristics, one member recalled. "We got on wonderfully well." The Bullingdon is infamous for drunkenly wrecking restaurants and an initiation rite that allegedly includes burning a £50 note in front of a homeless person. In Colditz, there were no restaurants, no real money, and no horses, but the mere existence of a Bullingdon Club was further evidence of a determination to translate pre-war social norms into the artificial world of prison. An officer's camp, Colditz was itself the bad boys' club. The Prominente represented an even more select society within it. "We were rather cliquey up there," said Michael Alexander. And the Colditz Bullingdon was the most exclusive subgroup of all, the club within a club within a club. After the war, former inmates tended to portray the Colditz prisoner community as a classless, cohesive band of brothers whose shared determination to escape somehow flattened out the distinctions and dissonances that divided the world outside. Exactly the reverse was true. "The class structure in Colditz was like the class structure of the time," said one new arrival. "There was a working class, who were the soldiers, the orderlies, who had to work. Then there were the middle class, officers from minor or major public schools. And then there was an upper class, with the Prominente and the lords of the realm." Alex Ross, Bader's put-upon-dog's body, referred to these special prisoners as the big knobs, and noted they didn't talk to the orderlies. The social divide between officers and their servants was strictly upheld. Ross played the clarinet in the band, but otherwise he and the other orderlies lived separate, very different lives from the officers they served, with their own quarters and no opportunity to escape. "We didn't even know when the escapes were taking place," said Ross. "They'd never involve us." The orderlies played football, but were not expected to participate in stool ball, an officer's game. "It was too bloody rough," said Ross, who was permitted to take part in cricket matches, but only when Bader was playing. "I detested the cricket. He'd hit the ball, and I'd do the runs." Beyond class, there were also divisions of military rank, service, nationality, seniority, and the different ways a man might choose to pass the time. One veteran observed that prisoners roughly divided themselves into five main categories: escapers, creators, administrators, the students, and the sleepers. Many individuals combined two or more of these approaches in their system of dealing with captivity. As at school, new arrivals were teased and demeaned until they had proved themselves. In early summer, 76 British officers were transferred to Colditz after staging a mass tunnel breakout from Eichstätt camp in Bavaria. The resident prisoners referred to them disparagingly as the Eichstätt mob. The new bugs did not accord the old lags the respect the latter felt they deserved. "We thought they were all mad," said one of the new intake. "They'd been locked up in the same place for far too long and were terrible show-offs." Some of the recent arrivals regarded the Colditz tradition of goon-baiting as childish and counterproductive. Others resented the requirement that all escape attempts had to be approved by a committee. Even escaping had an internal hierarchy, with veteran escapers at the top. Chief among these was Michael Sinclair, the most obsessive of the obsessives. In May, he hatched yet another scheme with Grizz Davis Scarfield, one of the officers who had escaped with him from Poznan. During exercise in the park, they would sit in a corner of the enclosure, leaning against the fence, and then gradually cut through the wire, working away surreptitiously behind their backs with a saw made from a serrated razor blade. When a panel was cut out, the other men would cause a diversion, the two men would break through and crawl up a bramble-covered bank, and then quickly slip over the wall to freedom. Davis Scarfield knew the plan had little chance of success, but Mike's enthusiasm carried me along. The Germans soon discovered the severed wires, repaired the fence, and banned prisoners from leaning on it thereafter. This was Sinclair's fifth escape attempt. His lust to escape, unclouded by a single distracting thought, made him the dominant figure of British escaping in Colditz in 1943, wrote Romilly. But while Sinclair was involved in every plan, he remained a solitary figure. Mike Sinclair was a silent person. He walked alone. Even the Germans were impressed. His red hair and bitter courage earned him the respectful German nickname Roter Fuchs, the Red Fox. With leaden irony, Eggers dubbed him the Great Escaper. But he admired Sinclair's persistence. The number of his escapes, the variety and ingenuity, the thoroughness of preparation and exactness of execution, all added up to an unparalleled accomplishment and a unique record of failure. The arrival of the Eichstätt mob marked a transformation in the essential character of Colditz. After 2.5 years, the Wehrmacht had reached the belated conclusion that it was a mistake to cram all the most recalcitrant prisoners of every Allied nation into one place. Instead of dampening rebellion, the chemistry of international competition and collaboration had made the place even harder to police. Henceforth, Oflag 4C was to contain only British prisoners, those from Commonwealth countries, and in time, Americans. The Dutch contingent left in June. The entire prison population turned out to wave them off. The French and Belgians were taken to Lübeck camp a few weeks later. A puce-faced Giles Romilly was found hiding in a French packing case on the platform at Colditz station with a packet of biscuits and a saw. The box had been left upside down and he was close to fainting. He would undoubtedly have suffocated before the train left because a lot of luggage had been piled on top so that the air hole drilled into the crate was restricted, wrote Schädlich. Commandant Pravit, whose neck would be on the line if Emil escaped, threw a tantrum and dismissed the chief security officer. The last of the Polish company departed for a camp in Silesia in August, leaving behind 228 British officers, a number that would grow steadily over the coming months. The admixture of British, French, Polish, Belgian, and Dutch inmates had lent the place a peculiarly cosmopolitan atmosphere. "I'm rather sorry to go," said Van den Hervel, the Dutch escape officer, whose contingent of 68 officers had achieved no fewer than 13 home runs. The French bequeathed an invaluable legacy. The radio, Artur II, was handed over in its stronghold, lock, stock and barrel. The British had known of the French radio's existence, but not where it was located. Before leaving for Lübeck, Fredo Gieg, lockpicker and radio technician of genius, led the British escape officer, Dick Howe, to the hiding place, a secret compartment between the floor of the Keller House attics and the ceiling below, complete with desk, upholstered chairs, blankets against the cold, walls lined with wool, electricity diverted from the mains for light and power, and maps to enable the secret listeners to follow the progress of the war. "The French have a flair for comfort and convenience," said Howe, impressed by this well-appointed secret lair beneath the floorboards. Henceforth, a two-man British radio team, consisting of an operator and a scribe, climbed to the attic every evening to hear the BBC news at 7 p.m, while an elaborate system of stooges kept watch. Back in the prisoners' quarters, the scribe would then transcribe the news from his shorthand notes. The bulletin was distributed to each mess and read out during the evening meal. The Germans knew a radio was in operation. They searched until they were blue in the face without success. The Bullingdon Club established their mess in the room below, on the logic that the Germans were marginally less likely to raid a place containing the Colditz elite. Only a handful of officers were privy to the precise whereabouts of the radio. Artur II continued to function, undiscovered, until the end of the war, providing a steady diet of reliable information, a daily morale-sustaining ritual, reminding the prisoners they still had a home and might one day return to it. The battle within Colditz was now a two-sided conflict between the British and the Germans. There was no longer a danger that an escape plan secretly mounted by one nation might trip up another. Colditz became a British prison. The hierarchy of rank was more pronounced. as was the control exerted by the escape committee, and the opportunity for one-man ventures was reduced. The Dutch Hawaiian band, the French cuisine, and the Polish choir were gone. The informal cultural osmosis between nationalities was over, as was the fruitful Anglo-Dutch partnership and the daily babble of diverse languages in the inner courtyard. Padre Platt noticed that, as an all-Anglo prison, the place seemed more cliquey, with small friendship groups, complete in themselves and almost exclusive. From now on, the plays performed in the theatre were strictly British. The Importance of Being Earnest, Gaslight, and Pygmalion. A man of cosmopolitan tastes, Reinhold Eggers lamented the end of Colditz as an international camp, but predicted that the camp would quieten down as a result. This, he later admitted, turned out to be wishful thinking. Eggers longed for the war to end, though he never said so openly. He and the other senior officers were under orders to keep up appearances, no matter what the morale of our men and no matter what the news. But that was getting harder. Secretly, he was also listening to the BBC. In May 1943, his 23-year-old son, a Luftwaffe pilot, was shot down and killed. Eggers told no one. As both a schoolteacher and prison guard, his watchword was, "Show no emotion." On the outside, he maintained an air of poker-faced assurance, and an upper lip as stiff as any of his British captives.